So this afternoon they've asked me to do another question and answer session, so therefore I await your questions. And if there are no questions, we can sit and meditate. What it is that there is the fact that there is what you might call an eternal state of Buddhahood. In other words, we are all inherently Buddha. And so there is that level of Buddhahood. I mean, in ultimate reality, you know, Buddhahood is. And then there is the Logur, which comes depending on circumstances. In other words, that yes, inherently in ultimate reality we are all Buddhas, but doesn't really help. There is then, due to causes and conditions, meaning due to the fact that we practice very hard, as Shakyamuni is an example, through eons and eons of time, he practiced and cultivated, and so therefore he became a Buddha. Right? So you've got the two levels. One, that he became a Buddha, but of course, ultimately he is already a Buddha. I mean, we're all Buddhas. So there is these two levels. The fact that in ultimate reality we already are Buddha, but then also the fact that due to causes and conditions we attain Buddhahood. So you have these two levels. Because merely to say that, well, okay, right, now I'm Buddha, I don't have to do anything, it doesn't help.
Would you give any advice on when we develop a lot of compassion, so we don't come to the point where we get too mushy?
This chair is extraordinarily uncomfortable. You should all have compassion for Rinpoche, who sits there for so long. This is a problem which is faced by many people, especially in the helping professions, that because they are endlessly caring for those who are, in states of great distress, they end up feeling totally overwhelmed by the whole problem. You know, that you're always... It's like you're breathing in a lot of darkness and there's no way of releasing that, so you end up feeling really very overwhelmed by the whole thing. I think endless compassion doesn't necessarily lead to being mushy. That compassion doesn't just mean feeling sorry for sick puppies. I mean, of course we feel sorry for sick puppies, but we should also feel sorry for healthy puppies. Compassion, genuine compassion, is feeling it's feeling the sufferings of others, but the more understanding we get, the more we realize that even people who look like they have, you know, good well-being, actually are suffering, because we are all caught in ignorance. And so, because the more wisdom we gain, therefore, the more compassion arises, because we see the real problem. It's not just the destitute and the sick and the mentally disturbed, the physically deplete. But it's all of us, we're all stuck in this. And because we don't see things the way they really are. So that level of compassion is a whole different thing from merely feeling pity for the obvious sufferings of beings. This is why, therefore, when we practice, we are trying to balance the genuine seeing clearly along with opening up the heart. I mean, when you think of someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he's a very good example for us all. Because, first of all, he's the leader of a people who have been extremely oppressed and are still being oppressed. Every day he hears horror stories. And because he's such a big leader, then people are always, he's part of many, many organizations for human rights. And so he's endlessly hearing about the horrors going on in the rest of the world. And people, they come to him, they see him as an emblem of compassion, so they dump their problems on him. And, so he's endlessly dealing with the tremendous suffering of other beings. But when he listens, when he hears, he's completely with that person in that moment. And, he will cry. I mean, I'm sure most of us who know him have experienced him breaking down into sobs. He doesn't care at all. I mean, he will quite happily, not happily, I mean, he will quite openly weep when he feels compassion. But then 5 minutes later, something funny happens, and he laughs from the belly. We all know. And this is because, although he feels the sufferings of beings, he also knows how to dissolve those sufferings into emptiness and higher wisdom. And he doesn't hold it like a big, heavy, black ball inside of him. And as a result, he keeps going. He doesn't get replete. I mean, we were talking just now with these people from Mumbai about the fact that so often people who are in organizations or who are working in NGOs, they're giving out, and after a while they get burned out. Again and again I get letters from people, and people come to see me who are psychiatrists, or they're working with street people, or they're working with in various kind of compassionate NGO humanistic organizations, and at a certain point they can't take any more. And it's because people know how to give out with their compassion, but they don't know how to bring in again to replenish themselves. And it's like if you're only breathing out and you're not breathing in. Or like if you have a cup and you're endlessly pouring, the cup is going to get empty. We have to fill the cup as well as empty it. So with compassion also, we also have to replenish. Is that answering your question at all? Or are you just talking about the feeling kind of sentimental?
No, that's not true.
Because it's very important that we have compassion towards ourselves as well as towards others. We are also sentient beings. And it's therefore very important that we also, that we heal our own wounds, in order that we can be healthy inwardly, in the spirit, to be able to function to benefit others. If we ourselves are sick, it's very difficult to really genuinely benefit others. So although the bodhicitta teachings are a lot about giving, this is to counteract our natural tendency to only think of me. But in fact, you have to balance it. And the Buddha himself knew this. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says you start by giving loving kindness and compassion to yourself. Because if we're not friends with ourselves, we're not going to be friends with the rest of the world. And so we have to start where we are, by making friends with ourselves, feeling compassion for ourselves, feeling loving kindness for ourselves. So that when we look at ourselves in the mirror, first thing in the morning, we can smile. Not go, Because unless we inwardly forgive ourselves and have appreciation for our goodness, we are not going to be able to give that out to others. We're always going to have friction and conflict and anger, and we think it's the problem is them. But of course the problem is ourselves, that we haven't healed our own wounds. So compassion also has to start inside ourselves in order that we are able to continually give it outside too. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, you know, Tibetan Buddhism talks a lot about self-cherishing. This is mostly because the Tibetans really tend to think a lot about themselves. And we all do. You know, we all put ourselves number one. So to cut that natural preoccupation with me, 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 we talk about others, others, others. But the problem is that if we already have very low self-esteem and we don't like ourselves, then that plugs into that energy and we end up being very mean to ourselves. And that meanness to ourselves and guilt if we're enjoying ourselves, because that self-cherishing mind, and that feeling that all the time we should just be thinking of others and never ever thinking of ourselves, just creates a very tight, tense, unhappy mind. It doesn't work. We don't lose our ego by bashing it over the head. So compassion has to be unconditional, which means it has to also include ourselves. And when we care for others, the one of the others we have to care for is ourselves as well as all others. Once we are, the ego, the sense of ego is well balanced and healthy and whole, then we can start dismantling it. But as long as our ego is fractured and injured and wounded, then it's like you're taking apart a piece of machinery which already is malfunctioning, and it just creates more problems. Dharma should be something to give inner joy and light to our lives, even in the most trying situations. There should be an inner joy. And if it isn't, if the Dharma seems to us like just another burden we're carrying on top of all our other problems, then there's something very wrong. It shouldn't be a burden. It should be the way to lighten our burden, to drop off the rocks that we're carrying on our backs. It's not an extra rock. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Because sometimes people take the Dharma so seriously. And I mean, obviously we have to be sincere. Obviously we must be very, very sincere, but we don't have to be serious. And if you think of all the lamas, you know, one of the things, the qualities which strike us most is their lightness. Even, you know, like just recently I was in Tibet in December, and I was meeting this lama there, and he'd been in prison for 25 years in a Chinese labor camp. But the thing which struck you about him was his eyes, which were twinkling away, happy, happy. And somebody asked him, oh, it must have been terrible being in that you know, the labor camp for so many years. And he thought, he said, no, no, it was like being in retreat. They even fed us. So if you take that attitude to your life and to whatever happens, then the Dharma gives a lightness. It should be like yeast in the heavy dough of our everyday life, right? A little bit of yeast in it and everything rises. And then you can bake it and it's very light and nourishing. It shouldn't be like a great big, you know, ball of metal in the middle of your dough, you know, sort of, you break your teeth on it. So compassion starts with yourself. And then from seeing your own problems and the struggle which we have with our problems, we extend that out to realize everybody is suffering the same way. And just as we want to be happy, everybody wants to be happy. And they work so hard to be happy and just create more problems. Isn't that sad? And then compassion is genuine, because we relate it to how we're feeling to extend it to how others also must be feeling. It's not just sitting there thinking, oh, may all beings be happy and may all beings be free from suffering. What does that mean? Looking at our own life and then extend it to how others are feeling the same. We are all very interconnected.
And Sampama, I wonder when you're talking about the song.
That's fine. Go go.
Why Tong Len then is such an effective practice? Because I don't.
Oh, thank you, love. That's very kind. Yeah, that's better.
Because I don't find that that same repletedness happens.
But that's because you are arousing always the light. You're not just absorbing in the darkness and letting it sit there. You're transforming it into light and filling yourself with light and giving it out. So you're replenishing. You're taking in the darkness, you're transforming it into light. So then you can keep going forever. If you were just taking in the darkness, then you would very soon begin to feel very, very overwhelmed, which is what many people do in the caring professions. They take in the darkness, they don't know how to transform that into light.
Yeah, it's interesting because as a therapist, when I practice Tong Len, when I'm working with clients, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And so I started using that with training therapists. And there was really a noticeable difference. But I never quite understood why, either in myself or in other people, why it works. Yeah,
it's very important when you're doing Tong Len, when you absorb the darkness, then to immediately transform it into the light. Because as Rinpoche keeps saying, as all the lamas, everyone's saying, in the nature of the mind, there is no darkness. There is light. So as soon as you absorb the darkness, then you turn on, as it were, the light of the nature of the mind and give that out, because that's infinite. It can take infinite amount of darkness into itself and just transform it immediately.
Yeah.
So this is the point with Tong Len, why it works.
I never thought of it in that terms, that you're transforming the dark. Mm.
There's a Tibetan practice in which, what would take an example, you imagine someone who you care about who is sick, imagine, and then you breathe in as visualizing like dark light all their negative karma or their sickness or their suffering. You breathe it in on the in-breath, you bring it in as dark light, it goes down into the heart center, it hits this little black spot of the self-cherishing mind, which is thinking, I'm really sorry they're suffering, but I'm glad it's not me. And so that cherishing mind, which is, you know, wants other people to be happy, but, you know, doesn't want to take their suffering, you take that in, on hits that little black spot. And then that little black spot immediately transforms. I mean, you could think of it like a diamond. It transforms into a diamond, which is your true Buddha nature. And on the out-breath, you breathe out all this light, which is your infinite good karma, all your qualities, the fullness of the wisdom and compassion of your true nature. And so then you breathe that out, and it goes to the person you're visualizing and completely suffuses them with light. And so on the in-breath, you breathe in the darkness. On the out-breath, you send out the light.
And is this for yourself or for them?
It's for them. But of course, it also helps you. I mean, because normally we don't want the sufferings of others. And in fact, many people say, this doesn't work, does it? You know, I mean, the idea that you're imagining taking in their suffering into yourself. And so people, for example, who do this with cancer patients are frightened that maybe it will create a seed of cancer in them. So this is very interesting also, because then you watch, you know, a perfect example of our self-cherishing mind. Anyway, it's a very powerful practice. You can use it in many circumstances. If you're with people who are sick, who are distressed, either in actuality or in imagination, you can also do it on yourself. If you are feeling very sad or very troubled in any way, then imagining yourself, splitting yourself off and bringing in that into yourself. Just because we should have compassion for ourselves also. It's just a matter of learning how to take the darkness and transform it into light, and to open up the heart by doing that. And it's something which is not any particular religious denomination. When I was in Thailand recently, I taught Tonglen a lot because people had heard about it and asked. And so we did a lot of Tonglen. And although they are Hinayana, they loved it. And then when I was in Vancouver recently at a Christian conference, I taught it to the monks and nuns there, and they all loved it too. I mean, they could immediately see the Christian relevance to this. And so, I mean, it doesn't really matter your particular religious background. I think it's very relevant. And it can even work in a way that people have often reported, that if they're sitting at the bedside of somebody who's sick, or even if they're not there, they're just visualizing them, that person feels a sense of being engulfed by light and feeling a lot of relief and wondering what's happening, that they feel so much better. So it benefits that person, it benefits the person that's doing the practice. But basically, it's to break down our self-cherishing mind. Yes, that's the other side of it. When you're sick, all right, say, all right, you've got a stomach ache, or you've got a headache, or you've got a really bad sickness and you're dying. Instead of lying there feeling sorry for yourself, you lie there and you do Tonglen. And you imagine, all right, say I've got a headache, absorbing all the headaches of all the beings of the world into myself. I will take their headache on myself now and give them out all my well-being. And that also works to make sense of your suffering, that you are happy to suffer. Then you're very happy that you have all this pain, because you're visualizing through your pain taking on the pain of all others and relieving others of their pain. So it makes sense also of our suffering. Whatever suffering we might have, we can use it as the path also to cultivate compassion and to cultivate a kind of joy in whatever is happening. Otherwise, you know, when we're well, we feel happy, and when we're sick, we feel miserable. And this is because we don't really have genuine Dharma practice.
Question?
Oh. I have a big voice.
Poor buddy.
Question. You mentioned that earlier, the notion of having a wound. You know, an emotional wound. I think everybody's familiar with that metaphor. Which is, so my question is actually that. I've come to think in my practice, in terms of meditation, in terms of talking about it, I've asked myself the question as whether there really is such a thing as a wound. If we can only exist now, in the present, and everything that's the past and everything that is the future is illusory, then how can there really be a wound from the past? You know, or rather, is it that we become habituated to thinking of certain things in certain ways, which causes us distress, and then we use a metaphor of a wound from the past? Would you agree with that sort of analysis?
Obviously, on an ultimate level, there are no wounds. I mean, on an ultimate level, since everything is emptiness, and we are all an expression of Buddha nature, there's no problem at all. I mean, on an ultimate level, we are all the fullness of wisdom and compassion and purity. And from time to time, it's important that we remember that. And that if we can really stay in the present, which is always slipping away, second to the moment, with the expansive open mind of pure awareness, there's no problems. But on a relative level, we are creatures of our past conditioning and creatures of our habits. We are addicted to the idea of a self-existent self, which we protect and which we strive to satisfy. And so, therefore, on a relative level, there are problems. This is what the Dharma is about. The Dharma is about the fact that on a relative level, in which unless we are enlightened, we live, the mind is filled with negative emotions and with our fundamental delusion. That's the reality which we live in. The fact that when we have real realization of the unconditional awareness behind the coming and going of the thoughts, we realize it's like those black clouds which have disappeared and all there is blue sky. But we are, unless we are very unusual, we are not living in the blue sky, even though the blue sky is always there. We are shrouded in those black clouds. And those black clouds, you can't just say, oh, those black clouds are just emptiness, and then everything's okay, because it isn't okay. So on a relative level, we are quite injured beings. And this is why the Buddha is called the great physician and the Dharma is called the medicine. It's because we're sick. Ultimately, we're totally healthy, but on a relative level in which we exist, as long as we believe in the past and the future, then we are on a relative level, and in a relative level, we are all patients. And this is why we need the Dharma. And the Dharma is the medicine, right? I mean, the Dharma is the medicine to cure our sickness, the sickness of the five poisons. And this is why it's very important. It's not enough just to know the ingredients. It's not enough just to analyze those ingredients chemically. It's not enough to put that medicine up on a shrine and worship it and offer lamps and flowers and bow down. You have to take the medicine. And if we take the medicine, then there is a very good chance it will cure us. But merely knowing all about it and in great detail all its ingredients without actually drinking it is not going to ever help. Ultimately, there is no sickness. Relatively, we are all patients.
Do we at any time? Do we at any time in our lives, in any one of the bardos, for instance in sleep or in dream or whatever, in waking life, ever make even a momentary contact with the unconditioned?
Yes. Yes, it's exactly what you're saying. At that moment of falling asleep and going into deep unconsciousness, at that moment we actually do connect with the nature of the mind. But because the next moment we sleep and we slip into total unconsciousness, we don't recognize it. This is the reason why in the Tibetan tradition they have the practice of the clear light, which has to do with the moment of sleeping, and then of dream yoga also. Because the dream is, sleep is considered like a little death. It reproduces in miniature what actually happens on a larger scale at the time of death. And so therefore, if at the time of falling into deep sleep, we can recognize the nature of the mind and elongate that moment of recognition so that we can remain in the nature of the mind just for a few seconds before falling into sleep, then we have the opportunity at the time of death to, again, when it comes more powerfully, to recognize that experience. It will be familiar for us. And if at the time of death, when the clear light nature of the very subtle mind arises, we can recognize it, as it says, like a son recognizing its mother, then we absorb into it. And then we, after that, the consciousness doesn't need to go into the bardo state. So therefore, the Tibetans take that as being this dream yoga and the clear light practice as being a very skillful way to facilitate the liberation at the time of death. And also during the day, there can be times when for a moment you experience the nature of the mind. But I mean, the problem is always that, you know, I'm not just saying this, the lamas say this too, that when you read books on the nature of the mind and Buddha nature, it all sounds like something very fantastic. And even the terminology clear light somehow gives us the idea of this sort of illumination that we're going to experience, and we will go, ah! And because of this, it's very... One time, one yogi that I know, he was one of our Toktans in Tashichong. I asked him for the lung, for the oral transmission of a Dzogchen text. And so he was giving this transmission, and then he stopped in the middle of it. And he said, you know, the problem with this kind of book is that it makes it all appear so far and so incredible. Whereas the actual realization is so simple that you might even miss it. And Mingyur Rinpoche likewise pointed this out, that sometimes when we get experiences, they can be very wonderful, you know, great bliss, illumination, all sorts of lights and visions, and wow, we think we're really getting near enlightenment. Whereas when we get the actual realization, it is so stark that we might not even realize that's what it is. And so therefore during the day there can come moments when we actually for a moment our mind kind of, there's this little gap, and actually in that moment we are totally just present. But because it's so simple and because there's no thoughts, right, because it's beyond thought, we don't recognize that, we miss it. Because our mind skips over to the next thing. And we've lost the fact that actually there was a gap. And that's one of the reasons why they try to encourage us to be as present as possible. It's so that if there is a gap, we actually are present and can see it. But it's not anything fantastic. I mean, it might even be a disappointment. Oh, is that all? And that's why the lamas, when they're giving Mahamudra teachings, the great lamas, they say, yeah, like that, you know? Because it's not like they go, you know, they, yeah, there it is. But it comes the most powerful time it comes for us is at the time of death. Because during life we just see the sun, and the sun is a son and daughter, not sun in the sky. The child. But at the time of death, then you see the mother, like clear light, very much more powerful. But normally, because we are not used to it and we don't recognize it, then we fall back, as it were, into a swoon. And we lose consciousness, and so then we end up, then we, when we wake up, when consciousness comes back, we're in the bardo. But if we are familiar with this, recognizing the clear light during our lives, then at the time of death we recognize it, and then we can absorb ourselves. And this is why many great practitioners, of course, stay in a state of what is called tukdam, or practice for hours, days, and weeks sometimes, when the body remains in meditation, but clinically one is dead. I mean, you know, there's no brain activity and there's no activity in the body at all. But instead of going into rigor mortis, the body stays supple, and also it doesn't putrefy, it stays, in fact, it often becomes smells very beautiful. Very beautiful perfume. If the person has been sick, they often, after a few days, begin to look quite beautiful and young again. And the heart center is slightly warm, because this is where it's considered the very subtle consciousness is. And so that is still there. The consciousness is still within the body, but it's all contracted just into this part of the clear light nature of the mind. And so then if the practitioner stays for long enough, then often also the body shrinks. And in other words, the qualities of the path are displayed most clearly at the time of death. Eventually then consciousness leaves and the body slumps over and it's a corpse. But this is a very common thing in a Tibetan practice. I mean, always, you know, not just lamas, but quite ordinary people who have got sincere practice experiences at the time of death. I mean, even up to the present day, I mean, you're always hearing, I mean, any would-be practitioner can go at least into that state. And it means you don't go through the bardo. Then after that, your mind, your consciousness goes through the pure lens.
What we were just talking about, it reminded me of something I've read about. Sometimes you can experience unconditioned mind when you experience orgasm.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could say a little bit more about, for most of us anyway, we're in relationships, and actually sexual, the desire for sex is quite predominant emotional desire in most of us. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how to bring that onto the path of realizing the nature of mind.
Again, the problem is that normally, I mean, there are very intense times during our experience when this appears. I mean, for example, not just in something dramatic like orgasm, but even in sneezing and yawning. There is that just that moment. The problem is that also in when it comes more intensely, normally one is unable to recognize it at that point because one is caught up in something else. And so therefore the practice of sexual yoga demands enormous amounts of self-discipline and cultivation of the bodily energies and so forth. It's not something which, even though everybody experiences it, that they can actually make anything of that experience. Because if even when this realization occurs in the mind, then the mind is already grasping at something else, and so it's lost. And that's why it's very important to recognize this condition in other times, so that when it does arise, you can recognize it in that moment. It would be very hard in that moment to be able to recognize it for the first time. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose I've
So therefore, that's why it's important also to meditate. And to get a direct experience of the nature of the mind. Then when you're accustomed to that, then whenever it occurs, you immediately recognize it. And in something intense, like in an orgasm, then you would not only be able to recognize it, but also to extend it. But I think on its own, unless you have done some prior preparation, it would be very difficult to make use of it in that particularly challenging situation. So the two have to go together. Otherwise, they wouldn't put us in retreat. They'd just say, okay, you two go off and have a good time. Recognize the nature of the mind.
About 2 weeks back, in our Bombay group, we were discussing Dzongkha Lhenkse Rinpoche's book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist?
Mm-hmm.
In which he lays out four propositions.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the ones of impermanence. All of our contact phenomena are impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
All emotion is pain.
Mm-hmm.
All compounded phenomena are ignorance itself.
Right.
Nirvana is beyond concept of time, space, and power.
Okay.
And to initiate the discussion, we started with the question, do we all agree with this?
Mm-hmm.
If we deny any of this, we are not a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a person who had come for the first time, but from a different Buddhist tradition. And he says, no, I don't agree. Life continues. From birth to birth, life continues. And then after a little more discussion, we realized we are actually talking about Buddha nature or the unconditioned and so on. And there was a little confusion in my mind. You also use the expression just now, we are an expression of Buddha nature. She used the word, how we get in touch with the unconditioned.
Mm.
Now, the unconditioned, or in the morning, a lot about Dharmakaya.
Mm.
Where does it fit in with impermanence, unconditioned, and emptiness? Is it unconditioned, is it also marked by emptiness, or is it not, or is it something permanent? But it's changing, therefore impermanent.
Okay, so you remember the fourth nirvana is bliss, right? So nirvana is what we're talking about. It's the nature of the mind. Right? So, when we talk about impermanence, we are talking about ordinary conceptual reality, which is going moment by moment by moment to moment. It's a river, right? It's endlessly flowing. It never stops. Dorje Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche have both been spending all their time explaining that behind that, you see, you have the clouds. The clouds are endlessly changing. They never stay the same. They're always, always, moment to moment. Even if they look like they're the same, actually, moment to moment to moment, they're changing. Behind the clouds, supporting the clouds, from which the clouds come out and go back, is the sky. Now that sky, from a Buddhist point of view, is unchanging. It has no center, it has no ending, it has no circumference. It is unborn, meaning that it's not something which came into being and then disappears. It is space, just is. And because of space, everything else can exist. If we had no space, then obviously we couldn't exist because everything is space. In this room, you look and you see the people, you see the chairs, you see the cushions. But actually, what is predominant in this place is space. But the space we don't see, we only see the objects. And those objects themselves are space, of course, as modern physics will tell us. So that has no beginning and no end. When we are talking about anicca, dukkha, anatta, we are talking about the phenomenal things which exist. Material things, and especially our sense of self. The body is impermanent. The thoughts, the ordinary stream of consciousness is a stream. It's moving moment to moment to moment to moment to moment. You cannot catch it. Behind that, the blue sky of the mind is our Buddha nature, is the nature of the mind, is the Dharmakaya, is Nirvana, whatever you want to call it. It's all just a word for an experience. Without the space, there could be no objects. Without this Dharmakaya mind, there could be no thoughts or feelings. That Dharmakaya mind is unborn, therefore it's also undying. And it is, but it's because it is empty in its nature as well as luminous clarity, it's not something you can grasp at and say, my Buddha nature compared with her Buddha nature. Claudia has a Buddha nature, but it's not like my Buddha nature. My Buddha nature actually is a little bit more polished and clear. It's nothing to do with that, because it's like space. You cannot say, you can say with this ground, right, I'm going to have that bit and you can have that bit. You can have that bit of cushion, I'm going to have that bit of cushion. But you can't say that about space. We're all breathing in the air. We're all breathing out the same air. You can't say, I don't want you to breathe my air. I mean, even Brahmins may not share their water or their food with other people, but they have to share the air. So that air we cannot, the space we cannot put into, you know, little packages. It's just air. It's just space. Likewise, the nature of the mind doesn't have a center, doesn't have a circumference. It's just the nature of the mind. And therefore, it's unborn, it's undying, it's unconditioned.
And marked by emptiness.
And absolutely, it's emptiness. But it's not just emptiness, because there is also that cognition, that awareness, which is called clarity. So it's both empty, but also it is knowing. So that's why the mind is not the sky, right? Because the sky has the empty bit. but it doesn't have the knowing, the consciousness.
Thank you.
One of the things that was mentioned in the translation a couple of times this morning about emptiness was that something about particles, it had no particles coming out of it. Of course, everything arises out of emptiness. And my interpretation of what she was trying to say about particles was that it had no solidity. But I'd like to check that with you and see if I... that's correct.
Yeah, well, according to the Abhidharma, they go, I was just with the Dalai Lama doing Aryadeva, and it was all about six-sided particles. The idea is that, as modern science says, if you take something and you reduce it to the atoms, and in the old Indian thought before, and also in the Hinayana schools, everything gets reduced to atoms. But then they said, but what is an atom? An atom has a, you know, a north, south, east, west, up, down, it has six. So which bit is the real particle? Because now you've got six, you haven't got one. And if you take that, you know, well, we'll have that bit, then you can again subdivide it. So it's like with scientists. You just keep reducing and reducing and reducing and reducing, and you never get to a part where you can say, that's the thing. Because there isn't anything like that. It's only our little conceptual mind which has to think there has to be a thing there at the end of it. Or when you keep it. I remember when I was about 11 years old and I started learning science for the first time. And my concern was, when you reduce everything down and down and down and down, what do you get to ultimately? And so I asked my physics teacher, and she started going on about protons and neutrons, and I said, no, 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 you know. But she didn't say that there was just energy. I mean, if she'd only said that, you know, but she didn't. And that's the point. You know, that science has also been trying to reduce, and they never can get to it. You know, all they can get is to this kind of quantum physics, which is a very whole different vision of our reality, which doesn't make sense. It has no time, it has no space, no anything. It works in a completely different way to how our mind can possibly grasp. And this is the point, our mind loves grasp. And so emptiness is the antidote to the grasping mind. So this is the thing about particles, is that, you know, you cannot take apart, you cannot say everything is just particles, because actually they discovered that those particles themselves are empty.
I was wondering, since our natural habitual tendency is to be quite distracted or caught up in thoughts, how can it be that the recognition is so ordinary? How can the experience be so ordinary?
I think it's very interesting that in Mahamudra, the recognition of the nature of the mind is called the ordinary mind. Because from our point of view, it's anything but ordinary. And yet, you see, it's not something other. The very fact that you can hear me and see me is because you have this knowing quality of the mind. You have this perception and this ability to be aware. Even if you had eyes and ears and nose, if you didn't have awareness, then it wouldn't function, right? The very fact that you can hear me and see me is because we have that quality of awareness behind the thoughts and the feelings and the conceptual mind. So therefore, moment to moment to moment, on one level, we are always in a state of awareness. Otherwise we wouldn't function, we'd be unconscious. Do you understand? We have it already. What we don't have is the recognition. We are so caught up in going outward and using that awareness to connect with what we see and hear and think. So we're all caught up in that, and we're not conscious of that knowing quality behind the coming and going of the thoughts and the sense perceptions. So what we have to do is to recognize that knowing, which is always present, behind the coming and going of the conceptual mind. So that's why it's called ordinary. Because it's always there. It's just we don't recognize it because we go this way. So it's not that we're adding something to what we already have. It's just that we're recognizing the real situation. And when we recognize it, then that immediately connects us with something very deep within our being, which is always there, but normally we just don't realize it's there. It's like, I mean, sometimes it's sort of like, you know, we're using a computer, so we're very caught up in all the programs and all the visuals and all that. We're very caught up with the computer. We don't recognize that computer is being driven by electricity. So we're not conscious of the electricity, we're only conscious of all those programs. So we're very conscious of all the conceptual programming of our brain. We don't recognize that energy, that awareness, which is driving that, and which is not in per se in the brain. It's beyond the brain. The brain uses that energy, but it is not that energy. So our conceptual mind uses our awareness, but it is in itself, it's not the awareness. Just like the clouds are in the sky, they come out of the sky, they go back into the sky, but they're not exactly the sky. And so we get so absorbed, like in the monsoon, all we see are the clouds. We don't recognize that the clouds couldn't exist if it were not for the vastness of the sky. Do you understand? The thing is, this is why it's so, and why the lamas say, you know, don't make a big thing of it. Because we're not trying to, you know, sometimes we have the idea, it's sort of like the spiritual path is like going towards the Himalayas, you know. And so we see all those big mountains and we're trudging along. And all we're thinking about is the mountains. And we miss the path at our feet. We miss the flowers and the trees along here because we're only looking up there. So what we need to do is come back to here. You know, occasionally look up, oh yeah, right, we're still in the right direction, there's the mountains up there. But the important thing is the road beneath our feet right now. Otherwise we miss everything because we're always waiting for something out there. Whereas it's right here, right in this moment, if we could only just see. It's not something outside of ourselves, it is who we really are. I mean, we all know, right? And it's just connecting with that the fact that we know. We know we're sitting here, right? If you sit and in that moment of being present, you are conscious of being present. Not thinking about being present, but just having that quality of knowing, of being conscious, of just being in this moment, that's it. It's not something extraordinary. And then when they give it all these big fancy high names, then it all sounds like something, you know, totally fantastic and unreal. And we think, oh, it's impossible. You know, these great yogis, they can do it, but us, we can't. But it's not like that. And that's why we say, sometimes it's so ordinary, you miss it. Because we're expecting something really startling. So you get a glimpse, and then you try to get a glimpse again, and again, and again, and then widen it a little bit, until finally, you know, I mean, if you're completely always in that state of non-dualistic awareness, then you're there. But that doesn't mean you don't function. I mean, you meet the very great lamas, and they're functioning, you know, 100 times more efficiently than we are. So this is good news. Don't look so serious. It does depend a lot on the lamas, but undoubtedly one often sees when the lamas are speaking to an audience in Tibetan and when they're speaking in, say, English, when they speak in English it's a lot more relaxed and more inventive in a way. Because when they're speaking within their own language, they tend to follow the tradition, because that's how they've been trained, and that is, to them, the purity of the Dharma is in having absorbed and then regurgitating what they learned and assimilating the many strands of their learning and experience and putting it in a way which is regarded as being traditionally orthodox. When it's very interesting to my mind, because Tibetan lamas, even a new lot, have been very, very traditionally trained. They memorize enormous amounts, and the ability to absorb and give it out the fruit of your learning in a way which is euphonious and pleasing, but at the same time very traditional, is very much appreciated. To be creative and innovative is not appreciated. It's regarded as being quite suspect. And so in that very traditional training in which they are immersed from their early youth, it's very interesting that now in the Buddhist world, in the West, and also in India to a certain extent, the most creative and innovative of the Dharma expressions has turned out to be the Tibetans, because they haven't been trained to be innovative. They've trained to be orthodox. And it's very interesting when you listen to the many of the younger generation of lamas, the way they express the Dharma is absolutely 100% Dharma. But it's often expressed in ways which will connect with the audiences which they're dealing with, which in Western audiences are very different from a traditional Tibetan audience. So it's very interesting that they have that capacity which normally throughout the centuries they've never been called upon to express.
Can you give some examples, please?
Well, I'm thinking of people like, I mean, in this day and age, we got Trungpa Rinpoche for a start, Chijong Trungpa, and Tralek Rinpoche, Trangu Rinpoche even. I mean, you know, he's orthodox, but at the same time, he's quite creative. Punlop Rinpoche, Ziga Kongpo Rinpoche, Ziga Zongso Chenzin Rinpoche. Minja Rinpoche, I mean, many of these lamas, the way they teach the Dharma nowadays, and the stories and examples, they draw it from so many different aspects of modern life and are able to communicate to the Western mind in a very skillful way. I mean, they're not perverting the Dharma in any way. The Dharma is very pure. But nonetheless, the way they're presenting it is in a way which will accord with the minds of their audiences in a way which is quite amazing, really, considering, as I say, they never got any training in that.
But isn't that part of their capacity?
Yes.
To connect in that
yes,
way?
Because they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
I think that this is a very great example of the fact that they have actually not only absorbed and eaten, but have also digested their knowledge, and they have genuine understanding on all levels of what they're talking about, so they are able to adapt it to the kind of audiences which they are meeting with nowadays. But of all the Buddhist teachers, I think the Tibetans have ended up being the most innovative, and that's quite interesting, really, because as I say, it's not at all part of their training or an aspect which would be particularly appreciated back home.
But it seems like it's part of their realization.
Yes, it is.
That they have the capacity.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. They have realized and they've digested what they have, so they're able to put it out in a way which is appropriate for the people they're talking to. Anyway, I mean, but when they speak take for example Thaisitra Rinpoche. When he speaks in Tibetan, it comes out sounding completely different from when he talks to Western audiences. And in fact, I know a number of Tibetans who speak good English who prefer to go to his teachings, which he gives to Westerners, rather than to the traditional teachings, because he is extremely funny. He's very, very funny, but also very innovative and very brilliant in the way that he presents the Dharma, so that it will be digestible to the kind of audiences he has to deal with, in a way which a more traditional approach might not be. So they can do both. But usually in Tibetan, they tend to be more traditional when they get into English. It's like letters. I know a number of Tibetans, I'm sure that Nima agrees, who prefer to write to each other in English, just because it's much more freestyle. That when you get into Tibetan, it gets very, very formal. I remember when my own Lama came to Rinpoche as his secretary, he used to receive a Tibetan letter, you know, it's a letter with, you know, all the lines, and he would just skim down the lines and read the last two lines at the bottom, which was the actual message. That much was all praises. You know, and I used to feel so sorry for these poor people who spent probably days and days composing these beautiful poetic phrases, but you never read it, just skim. Well, okay, what's the point? Oh, right there, you know. So it's much more difficult in to write a letter, a nice letter in Tibetan. You have to be, you know, all your grammar right and put it, phrase it very beautifully. In English, you can just write what you want, and even if the grammar's wrong, it doesn't matter, people know what you mean. So often they prefer to write to each other in English, just because then they can express themselves much more freely.
Is this new expression reading to new Dhaka?
No, No, that's what's so wonderful, is that the doctrine is the same thing. It's old wine in new bottles. It's the same doctrine, but it's just placed in new language with new images. But if you look at it, it's the same thing. They're saying the same thing, but they're putting it in ways which will hit at the heart of the people who are listening, which is a very different audience to what they would traditionally be used to. That's why they're so brilliant. They're not making anything up. They're just adapting. And of course, obviously, Western and probably modern Indian audiences have interests which might be different from a traditional Tibetan. I mean, most traditional Tibetans, they don't really usually go very much to Dharma talks. I mean, they're more interested in getting blessings, in... what are Tibetans interested in when they go to talks? And talking to Nima.
The traditional Tibetans are really, they have so much faith, as we discussed by Tsongkhapa Rinpoche, you know, in three categories. These are, I feel, to my understanding, and being myself a Tibetan, the older generation, they have immaculate faith, you know, individuals, and or all the Sangha. Sangha, everywhere you meet any Sangha, they have so much high regard. So the faith is so strong, and there is no question or the question of misunderstanding or conceptualizing in the wrong kind of misunderstanding is not there. This is my understanding. So whenever they do attend teachings, like Swamiji's teachings, but they won't go to private teachings or things like that, because they feel the message of his holiness comes out the same with all the other lamas, and so they absorb themselves in rituals and prayers and with so much of faith and dedication, sincerity and genuinely. But I must say, nowadays lots of Tibetans, because of the accessibility of modern education and because of the curiosity. And slowly now, the younger generation, the Tibetans, they are having this curiosity more, the Western kind of curiosity and the innovations and the creativity, they're coming up and they're attending lots of teachings and raising lots of their queries and things like that. So I feel that even in the Tibetan society, things are changing a little bit, but that doesn't mean that faith has deteriorated. I think the faith has been keeping quite intact. But there could be slight diminishing factor, maybe in certain areas or certain people. So that's my feeling.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing which the Tibetans have, as Nima says, is tremendous devotion. I mean, especially the older people, it's unquestioning devotion in the lamas and the three jewels. And so they don't have to be convinced. They already know that, as far as they're concerned, the three jewels and the teachers are immaculate and wonderful and worthy of total dedication. So they don't have to understand the finer points of the doctrine. Most Tibetans probably don't meditate, but they are very punctilious about making offerings and prostrations, going on pilgrimage, and in general having the objects of their devotion at the center of their lives. Whereas most Westerners are kind of wanting to be convinced. And also, of course, we come from a very different background intellectually. since we are all very educated, from Tibetan standards, very highly educated mostly, then also we bring our intellectual curiosity to the Dharma. So we want to know what, and also because we come from backgrounds which are not Buddhists, therefore we also need to know what is the Dharma and what is not the Dharma. And then to actually absorb it into our lives. So we're coming from different places, but it's all Dharma. The Dharma is many, many different aspects. It's not just one thing.
Wondering, though, isn't there a danger sometimes of romanticizing Tibetan people? And a Tibetan friend of mine told me that Tibetans, when they attend Dharma teachings, especially the older generation, maybe only understand 20% of the teaching.
If they understand that much, they do well.
And if you ask them something about the Four Noble Truths, a lot of Tibetans have heard that. So within the monastic community, often they say that that's also like kind of like a form of blind faith, which isn't necessarily healthy either. And I wondered what you thought of that point.
Well, I would say throughout the Buddhist world, not just among the Tibetans, the actual knowledge of the doctrine among the, not just lay people, but also often in the Sangha, is quite stunningly low. But general principles they usually understand. I mean, most Buddhists throughout the Buddhist world understand something about dukkha, understand about ethical conduct, understand about the importance of generosity, the importance of patience. The basic principles of how to be a good person, whether they are good people or not, they know. I mean, they might not be able to understand, you know, the 16 different categories of emptiness, but they certainly know that it's wrong to kill, that we should try to preserve life, that we should not steal, that we should not lie, and so forth. There's ethic that what we receive is the result of our past actions. And that, therefore, we should be very careful not only with how we respond to what happens to us in order to make good karma for the future. And basic principles like that, karma and impermanence, death, this basic conduct, you know, what is right, what is not right, this everybody knows. They don't have to read books about it. I mean, it's part of the air they breathe. And you know, even if people are hot-tempered, they know in their hearts that this is not right and that they should be peaceful and kind. And so it doesn't mean, because we know that this is how we should be, that we are. But nonetheless, those basic principles are, you know, you imbibe them with your mother's milk, as they say. And so also in the many Tibetan proverbs, actually a lot of those also inculcate the Dharma in the form of proverbs. So people, everybody knows those words. So those ideas are part of who they are. It doesn't mean that, you know, all Tibetans therefore are exemplary Buddhists, and, you know, I mean, you know, there can be rascals in any society, and there's certainly so in the Tibetan society too. But nonetheless, you know, on the whole, you feel that something of the Dharma really has percolated through to the people. And that's why I will say that, I must say, when I first came to India in 64, the Tibetans had only just come out. And they were very, very poor. really poor. I mean, now they're wealthy compared. They were so poor, many of them were working on the roads, laborers, including many lamas. Everybody was in it together. I mean, actually, high lamas, low lamas, they all were pretty much equal. Everybody was very, very poor. They had lost everything. They had lost all their status. They had seen their monasteries blown up. They had seen their family members killed. So often you heard that maybe 100 people were escaping and only 2 or 3 actually got through. They saw their mothers and sisters raped before them. They saw all their family killed. I mean, their experiences were unbelievably traumatic, and it took many of them months and months, especially if they come from Eastern Tibet, to get out. And so by rights, they had lost everything. It had all been taken over by a foreign power. They were destitute in a society in which the culture, the language, the climate, everything was alien. By rights, they should have been angry, bitter, and depressed. But what struck all of us was their joy, their lightness, their generosity. I mean, the Tibetans in those days, frankly, are much nicer than they are nowadays. They were such purity, such innocence, such devotion, and they were so kind. And they had that inner light and joy that all of us who met them were struck by this, how beautiful they were. I mean, on one level so traumatized, and on the other level so completely centered. And just being with them made you feel happy. One friend of mine, an American, she was working also in my lama's community, and somebody said to her, "Oh, it's really good of you to come here and help the Tibetans." And she said, "Oh, I'm not helping them, they're helping me." And that's how we all felt. I mean, we weren't doing anything for them. I mean, whatever little we could do was nothing compared with what they were giving us. And that's why the Tibetans became such a unique refugee group. Because they weren't like a typical refugee group. They weren't moaning and groaning, they weren't angry, they weren't bitter, it wasn't depressing. However poor they were, there was this inner joy there, this kindness, this generosity, which was quite extraordinary considering their extremely destitute circumstances. I mean, many of them were living in tents. The whole people in Tashijong, when I first knew them, they were all in tents. The monks were in one big tent where they slept and ate and studied and did puja, all in one tent. All the lay people were in little tents. Everybody was in a tent. And there was no running water. You had to go half a mile to get water. No sanitation, no anything. Everybody traveled on public transport. I mean, as a matter of course, even the highest lamas. And yet they were so always smiling, eyes twinkling. That is because in the depths of their heart they had the Dharma. The Chinese couldn't take that. They took their faith and their devotion with them. And as soon as they could get a little money together, they started rebuilding the monasteries. They started reordaining the monks. They got themselves set up again, just as they are doing in Tibet now. I just now came from East Tibet, from Kham, Nanchen and Derge. And there, the people there reminded me so much of the old Tibetans. So devoted. So sweet. And you think, 50 years of communism, what happened? You know, they have so much devotion. Every time they say a High Lama, they just melt. And then building all their monasteries again. Big shedras, big retreat centers, hundreds, thousands of monks and nuns in retreat or studying. Just came back again. And that's not because these people know so much about the doctrine, as far as if you ask them, well, what are the Four Noble Truths, they'll go, huh? But they know in their heart, okay, samsara is suffering. Yeah, it's impermanent. Yeah, look, we just saw everything destroyed. Yeah, we know it's suffering, we suffered. But we have Buddha nature. And the lamas, they embody Buddha nature for us. We can see, look, the Dharma really works because we have these wonderful lamas. They embody the Dharma, so we know it's not just theory. We don't know too much about the theory, but we can see, look, these precious lamas, they know. Look, you can see, because look how wonderful and beautiful they are. And this is what we can all become. And we can become that because this is what Buddha taught us. So it's not really a matter of just knowing everything in here. It's here that matters. And this is the problem for us as Westerners. You know, what's happening here? It's not how much knowledge you've got up here that's going to transform us. It's what's happening here that transforms.
And Anila, do you see any difference in the young refugee community?
Of course. As Nima said, they have been very influenced by, you know, modern world. I mean, look in Dharamshala, you know, it's samsara incarnate. And I have to say that I am a little disappointed in like the Tibetan children's village, the TCV. They get a good education, but they get very little Dharma education, it seems to me. I mean, our secretaries, all our secretaries who work with us, the Tibetans, they all went through TCV. They don't have a clue about the Dharma.
They just pray a lot.
They pray, but they don't know what the prayers mean. And nobody really teaches them how the Dharma can be used in their everyday life to really help them to overcome the problems which they're facing in their life. That the Dharma is an aid. So they just look on it as something very old-fashioned, and yeah, it's okay for monks and nuns, but it doesn't have relevance to me. And I think they find Westerners and others who come quite curious, but they could be having a great time in New York. What are they doing in McLeod? I mean, you know, for the young Tibetans, most of them, you know, the Western Pure Land is New York and Los Angeles. And this is so sad, because they are the inheritors of an incredible tradition. I mean, a while back, last year, the Dalai Lama was in Dharamshala, in Delhi, and we had just arrived in Delhi, and so our taxi driver said to us, oh, the Dalai Lama's in town. So we said, okay. So we called up to Bet House and said, where is he? And they said, oh, he's giving a talk at the youth hostel for Tibetans just outside Delhi. So we went there, and there was like a kind of theater in this youth hostel. And so we were up on the gallery in front. It was very nice because His Holiness was there. And on one side, about 100 Korean monks. On the other side, 100 Korean nuns. And then in front, some Koreans. And then Jetsun Pamela, the Dalai Lama's sister, was there. And a few other older Tibetans. And outside, the doors were open. So you could see outside, sitting on the low wall, were all the young Tibetan people. And they were just sitting there swinging their cutters waiting for His Holiness to come out and give them their blessing. The Dalai Lama was speaking in Tibetan. It had to be translated into Korean and English for everybody else. He was speaking their language. He's their leader. But they weren't interested. They didn't want to come in and hear what he was saying, his commentary on the sixth chapter of Shantideva or something. They could care less. They were sitting outside gossiping. And then when he came out, they'd lean over and offer their kata and get their blessing. That's all they wanted. It was very ironic. All these people came from all the way from Korea to listen to him, and it had to be translated. And yet these people that were so close to him, speaking his language, were not interested. So when we think about this precious human life, we should also think that one of the main points is an actual interest in the Dharma. Because otherwise, even if you're born as a Tibetan, and you have the language, you have the culture, you have the facilities, if you don't have the interest, then the Dharma is like, you know, has no meaning. And for many young Tibetans, this is how it is now. They are all very fascinated with the West. The dream of so many young men is just to find some nice young Western girl and go to the West, isn't it?
Well.
Yes, it is. It really is. In the cloud, do you know, there are over 300 Tibetan men that marry Western girls every year. That's one a day, practically.
Preferably American.
Yes.
I will see that Anila's experience has been living in India for a very long time, has been connected to the Tibetan community for a very long time. So it doesn't mean that I agree fully, but that doesn't mean that I also disagree fully. To some extent, I do have, you do your talks according to what you say, but regarding the final statement about the Tibetans being attracted to the West and the looking for the Western woman, I think we have to really understand who are these, you know, and these, there are lots of Tibetan people coming from Tibet. So these young people, they are uneducated, and they don't have any backgrounds in education and things like that. So they have lots of difficulties in the sustenance of life, you know. And so and also me being in Dharamsala all the time, I also observed seeing that there are lots of young Tibetan men who are attracted to the Westerners, and they go to the West, you know. I think they are the uneducated people, and they are from uneducated young Tibetans. They are from Tibet, but that doesn't count to the educated ones who are grown in India. But the percentage of the people who are from Tibet, who didn't get any access to a modern education, and because of the difficulties of, you know, sustenance of life and things like that, and maybe because of their personal interests, for the Western woman, or not necessarily for the Tibetan, you know, they could be some personal reasons also. So I don't agree fully that all the Tibetan men are attracted to the Westerners, you know, that I don't agree fully. And also I want to clarify a little bit that I have been teaching in Tibetan Children's Day School. I've been teaching for the 8th, 9th standard, I've been teaching there. So actually, during our time, the discourse of the doctrine was not that prevalent, you know, I agree fully. But nowadays, the awareness is coming up a lot, especially, yeah, it is. And even when I was there, I had started the Dharma classes, and I've started the Four Noble Truths and certain topics I have taught during the Saturday classes. And also recently, His Holiness the Dalai Lama have gave a talk on the 21st century Buddhists for 3 days for specifically meant for the Tibetan youngsters, the 10th and the 12th standard students, and all the college-going students were gathered there for 3 days, and His Holiness was talking so much on the importance of Dharma in knowing, you know, intellectually knowing, and taking that the part of practice. So because lots of us, you know, we Tibetans, we have so much faith in the three jewels, we don't question about that, you know. It has convinced us, you know, through our heritage and passed by our parents. But this kind of innovation and this kind of creativity of asking on a logical basis has not much there because we didn't have much intellectual understanding of that. So His Holiness was encouraging all of us a lot, you know, to really study more into the authoritative texts of all the Buddhas and the Aryas. So nowadays, from my observation, I see lots of young Tibetans are really showing interest, you know, into the Dharma, and lots are really practicing a lot. So I must say things are changing for better, although I must also say that the faith has, you know, declined a little bit, you know, because of the circumstances and because of we being in the foreign land, you know, we are exposed to different kinds of causes and conditions, you know, so that's the thing. But I think the preservation of the culture and the religion, I think it's coming more intact. This is my observation.
Good. That's good news.
Can I just add something to that? Because I'm, as someone who has fallen in love with a Tibetan man, in defense of the Tibetan man, in defense of the Tibetan man who's not here to defend himself, I would say that it's important we don't generalize as well, because actually people do fall in love, and there are some English men who are terrible and cynical, and you have dreadful relationships with them, and some Tibetan men, when they are with a Western woman, it doesn't always mean that they're wanting a passport. So I think I'm sort of agreeing with you, but I also do feel that, you know, there's a tendency Westerners romanticize Tibetans as well, and so it's just good not to, they're suffering like us, right?
Yeah, I mean, I know a number of couples in which they were not new coming Tibetans, they were Tibetans born in either in Tibet before, or born in India, who married Westerners and have been very happy. I'm not necessarily putting it down, and I mean, I'm sure that they, in their own way, also were very devout, partly because their wives were. They were so interested that in the Dharma that they got the guys interested too. No, I mean, often it works out very well, but it's just that there is... Most of the monasteries nowadays, I don't know, but they are often full. The monks are newcomers coming from Tibet, often uneducated, as she was saying, who go into the monasteries because they don't know what else to do with themselves. Not that many monks coming, I would think, from those Tibetans who were born in India. It seems to me mostly they're either coming from the Buddhist regions like Kinnora and Ladakh and Spiti, or they are newcomers. Most of the ones that I've met, at least, not usually, I mean, with exceptions, coming actually from the Tibetan refugee communities. Certainly in Tashajong, this is true also, that most of the monks now are from Kinnora, or they're newcomers, they're not from Tashijong. And our nuns, nobody in Tashijong wanted to be a nun among the girls. They're all girls, either the Tibetan girls are all come from, you know, new arrivals, so to say, or they're from the border regions, like this nun here. What would you say? Wouldn't you say that's true? I mean, there's not that many.
I feel back in Tibet, we didn't have the education accessibility, you know, the modern education at all. So coming to exile, we had lots of opportunity because of the kindness and the guidance of His Holiness Dalai Lama and his sister. You know, we have lots of schools that has been established over the times. So the stress and the emphasis of the modern education was very, very much emphasis and encouraged by His Holiness. And not only His Holiness, even the parents, you know, because they didn't have the education with them, you know, because back in Tibet it was not accessible. So they also warned their children not to send to the monasteries and nunnery easily, because there's an accessibility of modern education there is given by His Holiness and His sister. So they would rather let the children go there, and then over time, you know, through their own interest, they can go back to the monasteries or nunneries. So I agree fully that most of the in the monasteries and the nunneries, lots of the monks and nuns are either arrived freshly from Tibet or from Spiti, Ladakh, Kinor.
Anyway, I think we leave that here now. So, very lovely to see you, and see you all tomorrow morning.
Recordings of this talk?
Yeah. Tomorrow afternoon, how?